As our nation continues to plunge headlong toward a godless abyss, God-fearing parents will be faced with some tough decisions that, well, like it or not, will still have to be made with regard to who or what ultimately has moral and legal authority over the ethical standards we impart to our children. And this could involve being visited by our friendly neighborhood DHS agent. Our legal rights as God-fearing parents and what to do when the government comes for our kids, that's a tough subject today on License to Parent. Well, hello and welcome to License to Parent, the radio outreach of Shepherd's Hill Academy. Shepherd's Hill is a year-long, Christ-centered residential outreach to teens in crisis and to their families. License to Parent is our attempt to get what goes on inside the gates of Shepherd's Hill outside the gates so that you as a parent can be better equipped to raise your kids in the way God intended them to be raised. And Trace, I'm sure actually in your work at Shepherd's Hill, you have heard of this, but have you personally observed or been involved with a case where a home has been visited by Child Protective Services or a Child Protective Services agent for any reason?
Over and over.
Over and over?
I see it all the time. I mean, the type of kids we deal with, the families we deal with, we see it regularly. I used to have a DHS, well, I don't know what you call it in other parts of the country, but here it's called DFACS. Mm-hmm. We'll just call it Child Protective Services. I used to have one come to my house almost every day.
To your house personally?
Yep. My daughter-in-law worked for Department of Children and Family Services, and so she'd bring her my grandkids over to me.
That's not actually what we were talking about on today's program. Right. Well, it gets a little deeper than
I enjoyed when DHS showed up. You know.
Most families would not say that. Well, Trace, our guest today is someone who can perhaps not identify, I hope, with DHS coming to his home, but with some of the rigors that they go through and some of the things that we as Christian families may go through in trying to protect our rights as believers, mm-hmm. and the rights of parents to raise their children in the way that God might intend it. His name is Michael Ferris. You may know him for a number of reasons. He is the president of parentalrights.org. He's also chairman of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, defending parental rights since 1983, and serving as the president of parentalrights.org, Mr. Ferris devotes much of his time to meeting with members of Congress and to speaking across the country in an effort to raise support for the passage of a parental rights amendment. In his spare time, if you want to call it that, Mr. Ferris is also the founding president and the current chancellor of Patrick Henry College. That's a Christian institution with a mission of training students through a classical liberal arts curriculum and apprenticeship methodology to impact the world for Christ and for liberty. He's written over a dozen books, including three novels, a constitutional law textbook, books on marriage, parenting, homeschooling, political advocacy, and religious liberty. He also manages to host a daily radio program called Homeschool Heartbeat, which airs on several hundred stations nationwide. Mike and his wife, Vicky, live in Purcellville, Virginia. They have 10 children, 11 grandchildren, and Michael apparently, you took Proverbs 16:27 seriously when it said, "Idle hands are the devil's workshop." You do not have idle hands, do you?
Yeah, well, the funny thing is, by nature, I'm lazy. But my father pretty much did not give me the option of pursuing my natural inclinations and imparted upon me the absolute necessity of getting to work.
Great.
Well, Michael, welcome back to the Licensed to Parent broadcast. Tell us a little bit about parentalrights.org and the Homeschool Legal Defense Association and how parents can benefit from both.
Well, parentalrights.org has basically two missions that are both aimed at legislative changes. One is to stop any attempt to adopt the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child or the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities or any other international law document that would try to change the law relative to parents and children in this country. Mm-hmm. And we've been successful in those endeavors and have, you know, get the credit and blame for leading the charge in defeating those treaties in recent years. But our big objective is to pass a parental rights amendment. And we're working on some state laws as an interim measure to before we can get to a U.S. constitutional amendment. to make sure that the right legal standard is used whenever parents are in conflict with the government. And it's not that parents should always prevail, nor should government always prevail. Mm-hmm. We just need the right legal standard. And in simple terms, when parents' rights are treated as fundamental rights, then the burden of proof is on the government. And the basic rule that evolves from that is that the government cannot intervene in a parent's decision-making until there's been proof that the parent is harming the child, uh-huh. abuse or neglect or abandonment or something like that. And until there's proof of harm, if that legal standard is solidly in place, that will be the case. But unfortunately, we're moving in a bad direction on that.
Right.
So we're there to try to make it solidified that the traditional test stays permanently in our culture, in our law.
Yeah.
You mentioned the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child several times. How dangerous a thing is it? Can you lay out some of what they're trying to do that you all have been fighting against?
Sure. I mean, the basic problem with the UN Convention on anything is the word UN. There's a technical legal term that sometimes loses people. They're called yada laws, and I'll translate that. Yada do this, yada do that, yada do the other.
Yeah, right.
And if these UN declarations were mere yadas, that is suggestions to countries about how they should handle various policy questions, there's no problem with that. You know, let them say whatever they want to say in terms of, you ought to do this. But when they purport to create international law that's binding on the domestic law of any country, but it's, for us, especially in the United States, we're violating the fundamental principle of self-government, that Americans should make the law for America. So that's first and foremost the problem with these treaties. Mm-hmm. Secondly, though, treaties have been adopted in the last 30 years, the Convention on the Rights of the Child and so on, have a different philosophy than the original human rights documents. Parents' rights were very strongly protected in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that was written right after the experience of the war with Nazi Germany, because mm-hmm. they saw what happened when a country thought that it came first over parents.
Yeah.
And it was among many of the other problems, but there were very strong pro-parental rights statements in the first round of human rights documents, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Covenant on Economic and Social Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. All three of those documents that comprise the International Bill of Rights have in them all very good pro-family, pro-parent mm-hmm. rulings. But we've walked away from that. And the big change is this. The new era of these laws say that the best interest of the child shall control in every situation, which sounds like it's a question answering the question, what should be the standard?
Godly terms with the devil's dictionary.
Right? Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly. What it means is who decides. And the best interest of the child standard is the legal standard that allows the government to overtake the parent's mm-hmm. decision-making. And so if the government is allowed to make the determination of what's best for children in every case, you just found out who the real parent is.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. I was reading through some of the ideas written in that UN convention on the rights of the child. I got to tell you, I was scared to death. I look at some of that stuff, and it looks to me like, if I was a conspiracy theorist, it'd be easy for me to say this is their way of controlling everybody through their children. How far off base would I be by saying that?
You wouldn't be off base at all. Scotland has fully implemented this treaty, and they have assigned to every child at birth. They call them the named person. It's kind of sounds ominous, but it's effectively a legal guardian for every child from the government at birth, and that person is supposed to be a supervisor that makes sure that every decision that every parent makes for every child is according to the government's wishes. That is Big Brother, and it's ultimate, and that's the full implementation of this treaty.
It's like Nazi Germany. It's like Nazi Germany. How is this not like Hitler's youth?
Well, it's more intrusive than Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
You know, Nazi Germany had spies here and there. Here you have official assigned government mm-hmm. agents that, you know, they're above board. You know, I guess the difference is you know who's watching you in Scotland, whereas you were wondering who was watching you in Nazi Germany. Yeah. I'm not comforted by that difference.
You know, Michael, virtually every parent I talk to fears being investigated by Child Protective Services these days. And they feel that it's always an imminent threat to the integrity of their family. Is this a groundless fear or a totally legitimate one?
Well, it's... I wouldn't say it's either of those, but it certainly skews on the side of a totally legitimate one. Mm-hmm. It's usually a legitimate fear. The social services agencies investigate everything. Any scurrilous anonymous tip. I once had a case in the Alabama courts where I asked the social worker on cross-examination, if you got an anonymous call saying that they heard from their plumber's cousin's nephew that the governor had his kids locked in a box, would you go into the governor's house and investigate him on a complaint like that? Mm. And they said, yes, we would. Mm. And so the quality of evidence means nothing to these people. And the Constitution doesn't allow that. The Constitution, correctly understood, says that in order to come into somebody's house, which is a search, you have to have probable cause, and you have to go to a magistrate to get a warrant based on probable cause. But these people aren't interested in either warrants or magistrates or probable cause.
Right.
And any anonymous tip will do. And in the vast majority of cases, the stuff is frivolous.
Yeah.
Now, there are cases where there really is problems.
Sure.
And if they would use the normal standards that the police use for investigating wrongdoing, then we would have far fewer of these frivolous investigations, and we'd have more time, energy, and resources to investigate those cases where they really do need to be investigated. Mm-hmm. There is child abuse in this country.
Sure.
There is wrongdoing, and it needs to be investigated and needs to be prosecuted. But we need to, you know, by applying the simple rules of the Constitution and making sure that we just follow the principle of probable cause, we'll have the freedom zone solution to this, and we'll get to the right answer much more often than we're doing today.
Well, what constitutes probable cause?
Probable cause is a time-honored legal standard that has two elements. It means there's evidence that's more probable than not that wrongdoing has been committed and that a particular person is responsible for that wrongdoing.
And that's subjective, right?
It's a pretty objective standard, actually. You know, because there's so much legal history around it, judges and prosecutors and police know how to use it, you know, reasonably correctly. We get to the right answer almost all the time on that.
Okay.
And because we know what, you know, a few follow-on principles. For example, anonymous tips never constitute probable cause. And if we just follow that particular rule, anonymous tips don't constitute probable cause, we're going to get to the right answer the vast majority of the time.
Okay. So what actually constitutes child abuse?
Well, you know, there are statutory and common law definitions of that, but any kind of action by a parent that inflicts more than incidental and transient harm to a child, you know, if you spank your child and their bottom's red for a couple of hours, that's not child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take a belt and hit the child across the face with a buckle and it leaves a cut on the child's face, that's child abuse. It's not all, you can't simply, you know, go look this up in a book someplace and find the answer. There is discretion involved and there is judicial policymaking involved, but a lot of people actually would disagree with both of us. We both have said that, you know, a normal spanking on the bottom is okay.
Mm-hmm.
Others will contend, in fact, the UN contends, that any spanking of any child, anywhere for any purpose, no matter how moderate, is not only child abuse, it's torture. That's their contention. It's illegal torture.
I'd love to know if the UN has ever actually raised a child successfully to adulthood.
Yeah, well, that's a good question, not only for the UN, but for a considerable number of the social workers that I interact with.
Yeah, and scripture in all 50 states would disagree with them, too. Am I right or wrong?
Yes, that's right. Scripture makes it very clear that spanking is one of the tools in a parent's tool bag for raising and disciplining children. Mm-hmm. And every state in this country allows moderate, reasonable corporal punishment. So but the child abuse authorities, you know, beg to differ on that. But there's some rules of common sense, right. and people understand it. That's why you have judges. That's why you have juries. Is that the legal standards can be articulated, but applying those standards to particular facts does take judgment in particular cases. But the vast majority of it's pretty clear. Yeah. You break the child's arm, that's abuse.
Yeah.
The kinds of harm that we're talking about is usually pretty readily understood by people with common sense.
Yeah, but you used an archaic term in a postmodern world. You used the term common sense. And
How dare you?
to the degree that we've strayed away from a common standard of what common sense should be, it's harder and harder in our postmodern relativistic world to determine what common sense is. Because what common sense is to the UN obviously isn't common sense to us here in America.
Right, which is why allocating the decision making in a correct fashion is important. When we're evaluating cases at Homeschool Legal Defense Association, where we do lots of litigation on this issue, we have kind of internally what we call the 50-year-old judge rule. What will this case look like to a 50-year-old judge? There are exceptions to this. I have run into judges that are simply out to lunch, and yeah. And that's why you have appeals courts, frankly. But the vast majority of the time, on factual questions like this, judges usually get it pretty right if they get the right evidence. And so we have to be able to make decisions in society, and it's not 100% fail-safe system in any way, shape, or form,
right.
Because we don't have video for all these things that happen. And so you'd have to depend, somewhat on the legal system that we have. Is it perfect? No, it's not perfect. Is it subjective? Yes, at times it's subjective. But if we have the right legal standards in place, we're going to get to the right answer the clear majority of times. In fact, the vast majority of mm-hmm. times. But what happens is where we're is most cases in this zone never get in front of a judge. It's some bureaucrat someplace that's making the decisions and is effectively putting parents under probation and supervision and invading people's lives, and it never sees the light of day in court. And those are the cases where the abuse and the subjectivity in the postmodern view prevails in a very dominant fashion.
Yeah.
So it's, that world of the social services investigations is pretty dramatically wrong. And one measure of that is I was once hired by the Bush administration to teach a class on the constitutional rights of parents in search and seizure context, in child investigation context, to the directors of the state social services agencies for all 50 states. There was a meeting, I think it was in St. Louis, it was a number of years ago now, and I was making this presentation, and one of the state directors jumped up and started swearing at me in front of everybody. I mean, screaming four-letter words at me in front of everybody in the auditorium, which just simply gives you the indication of how violently opposed to traditional constitutional parents' rights we face in that system. So I think that part of the system is absolutely broken, whereas I think the courts generally and the police generally are pretty well squared away. Not perfect.
Right.
Not perfect, but much better than the social workers.
When we come back from the break, I want to ask you how we're supposed to respond as parents when the Child Protective Services agent shows up at the door.
We're talking today with Michael Ferris, president of ParentalRights.org, also chairman of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association and founding president and current chancellor of Patrick Henry College in Purcellville, Virginia. We'll be back with more conversation with Mr. Ferris right after this on License to Parent.
In the training of our children, what role should public school play? Documentarian Colin Gunn takes a panoramic exploration of this issue by hopping in a school bus for a field trip all over America in the DVD Indoctrination. Colin conducts a series of candid interviews and discovers how God's recipe for training the next generation is being replaced with a humanistic, man-centered program that fragments the family and undermines the influence of the church and the Great Commission. Christian teachers and principals share how they're attempting to walk the tightrope between teaching what they do not believe and being restricted from their God-given call to be salt and light. Indoctrination, Public Schools and the Decline of Christianity in America. Available in the Licensed to Parent store at licensedtoparent.org. Proceeds support the Shepherd's Hill Academy Student Scholarship Fund.
Teen rebellion, depression, addiction, rage, cutting, and suicide are destroying our families today. But there is a way out. Shepherd's Hill Academy offers a 12-month, Christ-centered, nonprofit residential program where kids are being transformed with a biblical worldview and often medication-free. Christian apologist Ravi Zacharias is just one of many Christian leaders who understands what's happening at Shepherd's Hill Academy.
It really is such an honor to come alongside Shepherd's Hill Ministries and Licensed to Parent to rescue those who have been seduced along the way. I cannot gainsay how important this is, and to get behind a ministry like this, one will find the rewards to be extremely powerful in changing society.
Get the help you need at Shepherd's Hill Academy. Go to helpmytroubledteen.org. helpmytroubledteen.org.
This is Licensed to Parent. You'll find us online at licensedtoparent.org. And today we're talking with Michael Farris, the president of parentalrights.org and the chairman of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. Michael, we've been talking about the threat, the danger, the concern that Child Protective Services might show up at my home as a Christian parent. How big a threat is that really?
We have about 300 incidents a year among our members of Homeschool Legal Defense Association. On average, about one a day for every work day and a couple on the weekends. It's a very real threat. And
why are they showing up?
Well, the vast majority of the time, it's someone has called in an anonymous tip about something. And in the vast majority of time, the allegations are absolutely scurrilous.
Right.
So, one of them I actually had to litigate. One of the allegations was that the mom allowed her kids to read books in the backseat of the van as they were driving around town. I mean, they came to investigate that. It's crazy.
Unbelievable. How should we respond as parents when Child Protective Services show up at the door? I was told that CPS agents will do about anything, including lying, to get inside the home. And should we allow them in the home without a warrant?
Right. And the first thing I would say is I'd ask them if you have a warrant.
Mm-hmm.
And if they say no, just say, do you have evidence that my child is in an emergency, dangerous situation, and they may or may not answer you, but that's the standard. Unless they've got evidence, either a warrant or actual evidence, there's an emergency going on.
Mm-hmm.
They can't come into your home lawfully, and so I would just simply tell them that you're not consenting to them coming, and that you'd be glad to arrange a meeting for them to. Come down to their office and talk to them. If they're concerned about the welfare of your children, you'd be glad to take them to their pediatrician and we'll send you a report. We'll take them right down today and have the pediatrician look them over.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we've had parents bring their children to the front door to simply show, not interview, but just simply show them that the kids are well and okay. So those are some of the tactics that we've used. I mean, for members of Homeschool Legal Defense Association, we also tell them, get us on the phone so we can talk to the social workers.
Yeah.
And so having a knowledgeable lawyer at your disposal helps.
Yeah, I was going to say, when should an attorney get involved? Or can they call you before an attorney or afterward? How does that work?
Well, if they're homeschoolers and they're members of our organization, they can call us, boom. At the moment they knock on the door.
Mm-hmm.
And we intervene regularly on those situations. And so if they say, we're coming in anyway, and they have the police there and everything, what I would tell people to do is simply to do this, to say, I'm closing the door, but I'm not locking it. I'm not going to resist you. I'm just closing the door to make it clear that you do not have my consent to enter. If you enter, you're going to do without my consent, and I'm going to take legal steps afterwards. But I'm not going to resist you.
Can that be interpreted later on as admission of guilt or suspicion of guilt?
No, not realistically. I mean, people can argue anything, but a responsible judge would know that that was simply an effort to show that they weren't consenting.
Yeah. Does a child protective service agent have the right to interview your child without you or a neutral party present?
If they're in your home, no. If they're in the public school, yes. That's the litigation history. Mm-hmm. A custodial interview of a child is considered a seizure, except in the context of if your kid's in a public school. You can come in and interview them there all they want. Unfortunately, that's the legal standard right mm-hmm. now.
At the school, they can do that.
At the school.
Yeah, the right. fact that they're enrolled in public school doesn't give them access to your home to do that.
No. If the social service agent comes to your school, takes the child down to the nurse's office and interviews them, your Fourth Amendment rights have not been violated according to the courts.
Wow. Mm-hmm. We've got just a moment left, Michael. For parents who want to get the best defense possible, how can they contact your organization and the Homeschool Legal Defense Association? And also, what resources might be available through parentalrights.org?
Well, there's a ton of resources on our website, available there. So just go and explore. If people are homeschoolers and they want to join our association and have us as their counsel, they need to go to hslda.org, and we'd love to have them as members.
And quickly, if you are a parent of kids in Christian school, for example, can you still join Homeschool Legal Defense Association, or is the cutoff that you must be currently homeschooling?
We could probably make an exception for this. If people who are in Christian schools want to join for Child Protective Services, right now on this program, I just made a new policy decision. We'll take it.
Well, that's very kind. I appreciate it. Our time has run out today, and we'd love to talk to you again in the future, but our guest today is Michael Ferris, president of parentalrights.org, chairman of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, founding president and current chancellor of Patrick Henry College in Purcellville, Virginia. I would encourage parents and students to look into Patrick Henry as a great school to attend, especially as a believer in Christ. Michael, thank you so much for joining
us.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
God bless you.
And this is Licensed to Parent, the radio outreach of Shepherd's Hill Academy, a year-long Christ-centered residential program serving the needs of teens in crisis and their families. You'll find us online at licensedtoparent.org. And I'm Rich Rossell, along with Trace Embry, inviting you back again next time to renew your license to parent.
And remember, folks, if you don't train your children, somebody else will. God bless you. We'll see you next time.